Shouldn't have said that, should I? I've Jonah myself. Well, we've been doing alternate light and heavy Sundays, and it's heavy Sunday today. It's the book of Revelation, picking up where we left off last time. This is part 49, Revelation chapter 17, verses 10 to 15. Now, if you weren't here last episode, we continued our investigation into the prostitute who sits on many waters. And we saw that somehow that will include, at least, some of God's people. We said, how could that be? Well, it could be professing Christians. Or, last episode tended to lean more towards those nations that have a Judeo-Christian heritage that will turn their back on that, or perhaps a combination of both. We saw that the beast being ridden by the prostitute is the Islamic Empire. And she's riding it because in her arrogance she thinks she can manipulate and outsmart this empire for her own selfish gain. We gave one example of this, which is the tiny nation of Qatar, incredibly wealthy as those Middle Eastern nations tend to be thanks to oil. And we saw that Qatar uses a lot of its wealth to buy influence in the West. Giving 747s to US presidents, for example, giving lots and lots of money, millions in grants to Ivy League universities in the States to promote wokeism, which they personally detest, but they want to implode the Western culture. I think I mentioned, and they support terrorists as well, of course, financially, and I think I mentioned last time that it's very difficult to get a journalist to go, for example, to Gaza, unless you're approved by Al Jazeera. Normally you have to rely on stringers through Al Jazeera as the official network, and that's why the news is all biased. And I forgot to mention that Qatar owns Al Jazeera, of course. In the process, the prostitute will be either directly or indirectly responsible for the death of those who are precious to the Lord. Revelation 17, verse 6, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And that's why from his perspective in the first century, when John saw it, he says, when I saw her, I wondered with amazement. How could God's people betray God's people? Moreover, we saw that those who have not yet decided which team they're on in the last days will automatically side with the beast. They will lose the option to decide in the last days. Why? Because the first horseman, deception, has done its job well. And in my opinion, that first horseman has ridden already in our age. The world's getting crazy. Our final verse last time, we saw the beast with seven heads is further described. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And I said that contrary to popular opinion, that's not the city of Rome, the city of seven hills. Rather, this is Jewish apocalyptic literature, and mountains are symbols in that style of writing. And what are those symbols? Well, let's remind ourselves, they are kingdoms. Mountains are kingdoms and empires in apocalyptic thought. Now, if mountains represent empires or kingdoms, what do seven kingdoms need? Well, our first verse this morning, verse 10, there are also seven kings, which makes sense for seven kingdoms, right? And as it happens, seven empires throughout history have oppressed God's people. From John's perspective in the late first century, five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. From his perspective, the five that have fallen were Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. The one that was, is, in the first century, was of course Rome. And there was one yet to come from John's perspective, which was the Islamic Caliphate. Well, the text continues. What do we know about this seventh empire that was yet future from John's day? When he comes, he must continue a short while. What does that mean? The word oligos means literally a few or a handful. So we get words like oligarchy and oligopoly in English and so on. So in context, it means for a little while. So is that a little while from our perspective? Or is it a little while from God's perspective, which would be a long while from our perspective? Which one is it? Remember, Hitler decided he was going to have a 1,000-year Reich. That would be a little while from God's perspective. In fact, it only lasted 12 years, which is a little while from our perspective, if that makes any sense. From our perspective, an empire that hangs around for a while would probably be a few decades, maybe 50 years at the outset. But from God's perspective, it would be longer. The precedent in Revelation, in fact, in the very first verse of the book, is that we're talking about God's perspective on time. Revelation 1 verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. And that shortly has been, what, 1900 years so far or more. Also, there's a text where it says we saw there was silence in heaven for half an hour. Was that 30 minutes by our time? Or does that mean, you know, longer from earthly perspective? Who knows? Well, this one, the one that followed Rome, did hang around for quite a while from our perspective. It got started in the early 7th century, morphed into the Ottoman Empire, and wasn't finally put down until World War I. And it's back. So a little while from God's perspective was roughly 1,300 years. To continue, the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. Well, how can there be eight beasts if there's only seven empires? The text tells us it is of the seven and going to perdition. Of the seven, ekton heptah means out from the seven. Now, I've said for many years that this is one of the seven empires making a comeback. And I still stand by that, but I need to correct that a little bit or add to that, which I will in just a moment. But lots of folks have said it'd be one of the seven making a comeback. Most notable back in about 1970, of course, was dear old Hal Lindsey. Wrote a bestseller. I read it. Anyone else read The Late Great Planet Earth? Yeah, there's two of us, three of us. Yep, four of us. In that time, he said, my money, sorry, I got ahead of myself. As we've seen, a conglomeration, the final terrible beast, bottom right, is a conglomeration of the four empires that Daniel saw from his perspective in the 6th century BC. And put them together, they have seven heads, right? The final terrible beast at the bottom is characterized not just by one of the empires making a comeback, Islam, in my opinion. It will also be the worst of Babylon, the worst of Persia, and so on. Now, Babylon was one of the greatest empires, most glorious empires ever in human history. But it wasn't all beer and skittles. You know, they were cruel men, but fair. So this will be the worst of everything combined in a final, in my opinion, Islamic empire, unless the Lord tarries for lots more decades. Notice, of course, we saw it last time, that final beast has 10 horns. Well, let's continue. Verse 12. The 10 horns that you saw, here it is again, are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet. If mountains are empires, then in Hebraic thought, in apocalyptic symbolism, horns represent power. And that's why back in the day, kings' crowns originally looked like that. They had horns to show that they were the one with the power. They're more sort of stylized horns now, aren't they? But horns are kings or powers. So if it's literal, and I don't know if it is, 10's the number of human responsibility, right? But if the 10-nation, if literal, confederacy, not around in John's day, but in the future from his perspective, it will be a coalition committed to the destruction of God's people. That's why the final amalgamated beast has 10 horns. And as we saw in Daniel's vision, also a little horn, which speaks blasphemous things and arises to prominence from among the others. And we said this is probably representative of the Antichrist or his kingdom. Here's that passage from Daniel. We haven't looked at it for years. Daniel 7:24, the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise, same as Revelation, from this terrible final kingdom or beast. Here comes the little horn. And another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first three ones and shall subdue three kings. Interesting word, this subdue. This is one of those handful of chapters in the Old Testament to be written in Aramaic rather than Hebrew. And it's the Aramaic word shafal, which means to humiliate or bring low. Doesn't mean necessarily to kill. The humiliation of three kings or powers will be the turning point for the final tribulation, probably following a period of false peace. Verse 25, he, the little horn, shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. And as we've seen in the past, the word times there is the Aramaic equivalent of the Hebrew word moedim, which means the religious festivals. He will get rid of the religious festivals. There'll be no more Passover and Pentecost or tabernacles. There'll be Ramadan and Hajj and Eid and things like that. And no Christmas or Easter either. How sad. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, times and half a time. Probably this is literal, for 3.5 years. The great tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble, out of which Israel shall be saved. So can we identify this 10-nation confederacy that makes up the final coalition? There's five of them for a start. But we've actually done this before here in Deloraine Baptist Church. So it's old hat for many people. But not everyone was here with us when we did it. So we'll go over it again in an abridged version just for folks who haven't been with us a long time. And what we'll do is we'll start with, there are two passages, Ezekiel 38 and Psalm 83. We'll start with Ezekiel 38. We'll just hit the verses with the nations in them in the interests of time, okay? So here we go. Verse 1. This will be during a time of peace when Israel is living with unwalled villages at peace. This is the false peace. Here we go. The word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, set your face against Gog, that's a person. Gog is a person, of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. Now, which nations are they today? Well, if we go back to dear old Hal Lindsey, he said this was the peace-loving people of the Soviet Union. And he claimed that Rosh was Russia, because it sounds like Russia. Meshech was Moscow, because it sounds like Moskva. And Tubal was clearly Tobolsk. And you can't argue with fact like that, can you? Ding! But the trouble is, Rosh is not a place. It's a word in Hebrew. It means your head. And in Hebrew, it's used the same way as we use it in English. It's your head. Or it can be a principal person, like a headmaster or a head chef or something like that. And that's the context it's used in here. In Hebrew, Prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal is Nazilos Meshech for Tuval, which means the chief ruler of Meshech and Tubal. So Russia, Rosh isn't a place at all. What else? We'll go to verse 5 now. Persia, Ethiopia and Libya. We're familiar with those terms, and that's because the translators have helped us a bit. The word is indeed the word for Persia, but Ethiopia and Libya, not quite. What it says is Paras Kush Ufut. Persia, as it was once upon a time, or as it will be in the last days, I should say, Kush and Put, slightly different to what they've said in English. And finally, we have Goma and all its troops. Hal Lindsey said that's Germany because it sounds like Goma. The House of Togarmah from the far north. So what we have here is an eight-nation alliance. If indeed Magog is one of the nations, because it's Gog of Magog who is the chief prince of these other places. Maybe Magog's a player, maybe it isn't. But what do we have that we don't know about? Well, we know Persia, Kush and Put. We know roughly where that is, so we can get rid of them. That leaves us with five unusual place names. And they're all found in Genesis chapter 10, the Table of Nations. Genesis chapter 10, verse 1. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. Why? Who were their sons? Tell us. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech and Tiras. The sons of Gomer, so Japheth's grandsons through Gomer, were Ashkenaz. You heard that word before? Yeah, that's European Jews are Ashkenazis, aren't they? And in modern Hebrew, Ashkenaz means Germany, actually. But the sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz, Rifath, and Togarmah. So there's our five nations, all descended from Japheth. So we've done this in the past, but let's look at it on a modern map of the Middle East. Here's our key. We've got Gog's alliance, which today would be Turkey and northern Iran, like that. Persia actually is more than Iran. It includes Iraq and a large portion of Afghanistan. Kush is eastern Egypt, Ethiopia, Sudan and Eritrea. And Put across North Africa, Mauritania, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia and Libya. Do you reckon any of these nations could be hostile to Israel today? I think it's possible, don't you? Well, Psalm 83 gives us some more information, beginning in verse 4 and following. They have said, the bad guys, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria has also joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot, Selah, which I think is a word for a pause in the music, a musical term. So that gives us an alliance of 11 nations. Edom, Ishmaelites, Moab, Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, Tyre, Assyria, and that's the lot. So let's convert this now to their modern place names. We'll do it one verse at a time. Here we go. Verse 86 should say, in today's terms, there will be some overlap. The tents of the Palestinians, southern Jordanians and the Saudis. Palestinians again and central Jordanians and the Egyptians. Verse 7. Northern Lebanon, the Palestinians, the northern Jordanians, Gaza, which of course is controlled by Hamas and still is controlled by Hamas despite the agreement, with the inhabitants of southern Lebanon, Hezbollah. Finally, we have verse 8, Syria and northern Iraq, they have helped the children of Jordan. And because we don't say Selah in Australia, it's Sheila. Thank you. So, if you put the nations of Psalm 83 there, it really just describes the area immediately surrounding Israel. The area of the Promised Land is what it does. Now, the odd man out here really is Persia, because Persia is predominantly Shiite. The rest are, to a large degree, Sunni. This map shows us the degree of Shia within the Muslim nations. The sort of tan-coloured countries are 10% or less, right through to dark green, which is 75 to 100% Shiite, which is Iran, Kuwait, Bahrain and Qatar. Imagine that. Then down the south of Saudi, you've got Yemen, which is probably 50%, and that's why they have the Houthis there, paid for by Iran, firing their missiles and things like that. Turkey, Syria, Afghanistan and Pakistan are a little bit of both. They're probably 20% Shia. So how could the Sunnis and the Shias ever come together? They hate each other. I mean, it's happening, isn't it? There are countries like Qatar and Iran funding Hamas, which are Sunni. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. But we've seen before that according to Islamic belief, this chap will do just that, the Imam Mahdi. He will unite the tribes of or the houses of the Sunnis and the Shia, bring them all together, and then he, with Jesus as his second in command, will come and kill all the bad guys. Notice his funny sword there has two points at the end. I remember, it's called a Zulfikar. I remember being stuck in a cab in the rain one night, waiting for my beloved Michelle to come and pick me up for 45 minutes with this guy, we were early, and he's drawing this sword for me on his receipt book, and he's urging me to convert to Islam because, you know, the Mahdi is going to cut my head off if I don't. Well, I've enjoyed our chat. Hurry up, Michelle, hurry up. Now, this photograph, by the way, comes from a YouTube video that teaches children how they can make their very own Zulfikar. What a funny old lot they are. Now, consider Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the four beasties that Daniel saw in his vision. He saw them from God's perspective, brute beasts. From Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king's perspective, it was a splendid statue, right? The head of gold was Babylon, the silver chest was Persia, the bronze thighs Greece, and then you had the two legs of iron, which traditional commentators say is Rome, the western and eastern half of the empire. I say it isn't. I say Rome was but a partial fulfillment. As we've seen, it did not conquer Babylon. Rather, it is Islam, and the legs are Shia and Sunni. Remember, the toes were made of iron and clay, weren't they? They don't naturally mix. Daniel 2, 42, 43. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mixed with clay. They will come together for a season in their attempt to annihilate Israel while it dwells at peace. Hamas, as I've said, receives funding from Iran, which is Shia. This is a photograph, I think it's their 25th anniversary of being in government in Gaza. It's not, we're not looking at a handful of nutters. There's lots of them, isn't there? Lots and lots of Hamas ruling Gaza, and they still have more than 50% support of the population. Can you believe it? Despite what they tell you. But again, as I said, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Well, back to our ten-horned last day's terrible beastie that has all the bad attributes of the preceding ones. Is Daniel's little horn alive today? And if so, who is he? Pure speculation, folks. This is not thus saith the Lord. This is just a guess. Could be completely wrong. All right? This is just as of today. Might change my opinion next week. Watch this bloke. Watch Ahmed al-Sharaa, the new president of Syria. Formerly Abu Muhammad al-Jilani, the ISIS and al-Qaeda terrorist. But now he wears a suit and he's a really nice guy. Leopards change their spots. The Bible's wrong. There you go. He subdued a king, didn't he? He subdued the king of the president of Syria, Assad al-Bashar. Didn't kill him. He's hiding in Russia somewhere. He's being bankrolled by Erdogan, the leader of Turkey. He's big on talk and he's a full-on Islamist, but he prefers to do his dirty work through proxies. So he's bankrolling our old mate with the split personality. So keep an eye on him. He is the guest of honour at the White House tomorrow. How'd you like that, eh? Perhaps the US president is confident that he can outsmart and manipulate him. Saw a good line the other day. I think it was the subtitle for a book, but it was this: sacrificing discernment for the sake of spectacle. Is the US doing that at the moment with the Abraham Accords and so on? Sacrifice, you know, getting into bed with anyone so that we can say, look what I've done. I don't know. Only God knows. Don't say I hate President Trump. I admire a lot of the things he does. But I think he could be potentially taken for a ride if he's not as smart as he claims to be. Time will tell. Well, back to Revelation. Almost finished now. Verse 13, the Ten Nation Conspiracy, if literal, have one mind. They give their power and authority to the beast. In other words, they place themselves at the Islamic Empire's disposal to use as it sees fit. To what purpose? These will war against the Lamb. Who's the Lamb? The Lamb's the risen Christ. They're going to win? No, of course not. The Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. Will he do this single-handedly? Or will he have some help? And those who are with him are called faithful, are called chosen and faithful. Who are they? The ones called chosen and faithful. Look in the mirror, folks. That's us. In what sense will we be with him? Does it mean ideologically aligned? No. Meta means with, among, accompanying him. You've looked at it that way? Is that supported anywhere else in the Bible? Yeah, Jude 14, 15. Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men, also saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. What for? To execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them. A couple of chapters hence in Revelation, chapter 19, verse 14, the armies which are in heaven, clothed in white, pure fine linen, followed him on horses. Who are they that are clothed in white? Go back to chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. One of the elders answered, saying to me, "These who are arrayed in the white robes, who are they and where do they come from?" I told him, "My Lord, you know." He said to me, "These are those who came out of the great suffering. They washed their robes and made them white in the Lamb's blood." This is the martyrs. Is this bit literal, following on white horses? Well, if it is, they need to be physically resurrected first, because they're not yet resurrected, even though they're in the presence of the Lord, along with the rest of the saints. That's not till the end, is it? 1 Corinthians 15, 20 and to 23, Christ is risen from the dead, has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. He's the only one physically immortal, resurrected at the moment. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive, but each one in his own order, Christ the first fruits. What about the rest of us? Afterward, those who are Christ's at his coming. As Christ returns, the spirits of those who are with him will be reunited with their glorified and raised bodies, and the rest of us who are still alive will be transformed in the twinkling of an eye, as Paul declares, 1 Corinthians 4, 16 to 17, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first." Jump on their horses, if it's literal. "Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord," not in heaven, "in the air." It's the Greek word aer, means air, so we've got the word aeroplane from. "And we will accompany him on his journey to the promised land to execute judgment on the wicked." Last verse for today. We saw it in preview a couple of episodes ago. Verse 15, "He said to me, 'The waters which you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations and languages,'" which adds weight to it being formerly Judeo-Christian nations. And if you weren't here, we looked at the map of all those nations who fell over themselves to recognise the non-existent state of Palestine, including our own. What will happen to the prostitute? Now that's what we'll look at next time, which will be in about 3 weeks, I think. In the meantime, what can we take away? Well, half a dozen points. Firstly, Antichrist will subdue three kings or powers in his rise to prominence, whoever it turns out to be, which may bring about a time of false peace that will usher in the time of Jacob's trouble, out of which Israel shall be saved. This is a time for Israel worse than the Holocaust. Unimaginable what it'll be. Christ will destroy the evil empire as he returns with his people. Is your passport up to date? Can you ride a horse? Now, you don't need a passport. What I mean by that is, which of the three books is your name written in? If it's not in the book of life, the days are coming when it's too late to decide. Get it sorted before it's too late. Because there's only really two books in the last days, isn't there? That's all, folks. What are we now? The 9th. I won't be here next Sunday, but Sunday week, we'll go back to our BBC Light program, some thoughts on evangelism, and we'll look at the subject of influence.